Culture Affidavit, episode 169, Robin Lives. Hello and welcome to episode 169 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Paneris. And this time around, I'm going back into the DC Comics vault, as DC did, with a look at the return of Jason Todd, but not in the way that it was actually in canon. No, what I've decided to do is take a look at the recent revision of issue number 428 of Batman, which originally featured the death of Jason Todd, or at least the discovery that Jason Todd was dead. And then I will follow it up with the miniseries that came out afterward called Robin Lives. So Robin as a character is somebody I've been following since I first started collecting comics. I came into being a comic fan and being a Batman fan partially through the film in 1989, but then upon reading my friend's copies of the Lonely Place of Dying storyline and finding out who Jason Todd was and how Dick Grayson had become Nightwing, or that Dick Grayson had become Nightwing, and that there was this kid named Tim Drake out there, I decided to go check out Batman comics. And as I've said before, the first issue of Detective and Batman that I bought were The Return of the Joker, and then that was followed by Detective number 618, which is where Tim Drake's parents get kidnapped in Haiti. And that eventually will lead to his mom's death, his dad's paralysis, and then over in Batman 455 or 457, there is that outstanding three-part storyline where they face off against the Scarecrow, and in the very end, Tim breaks into the Scarecrow's hideout where he's holding Batman and wins, essentially. This time, though, in kind of a not totally parallel to A Lonely Place of Dying, he's not wearing the Robin costume like he was in that, but he gets the Robin costume at the end. But before him was Jason Todd, the whole reason Batman didn't have a Robin for the better part of a year and a half or 2 years. Jason was first introduced in the early 1980s, around 1982, 1983, as essentially a replacement for Dick Grayson. There's a whole storyline involving a circus and Killer Croc and the squid. And that's how Jason became part of Bruce's life. And then over in the New Teen Titans, Dick was essentially outgrowing his role as Robin. And in New Teen Titans number 39, with the iconic cover of Dick and Wally walking away with all the clothes hanging around, he quit being Robin. And by the end of the Judas Contract storyline, he was Nightwing. Now, the pre-crisis Jason Todd, as anybody will tell you, was much different than the Jason Todd that was killed in Batman 427 and 428, the storyline known as A Death in the Family. That Jason Todd was very Dick Grayson-like, like a junior version of Dick Grayson. There was, his parents had been in the circus, and there were some sort of other storylines. There was a prolonged storyline after he became Robin with him and Nocturna adopting him. I've never read the whole storyline. I've read bits and pieces, but I know that it went on for quite a while. And then Crisis happened. Batman and Robin don't have a heck of a lot to do in Crisis, if I'm being completely honest with you. And after Crisis, there is still some of the pre-Crisis Jason Todd sticking around. Especially if you read Mike W. Barr and Alan Davis's brief run on Detective Comics in 1986, that Jason is very much a wisecracking, pixie boots wearing Robin. And he basically gets reset after year one happens. In fact, he actually has a appearance in a couple of issues of the New Teen Titans, the Baxter series, fighting alongside the team. And it's clearly that's the, kind of the older version. It's still all of this part of this crisis hangover that I once talked about. So anyway, we get through that. Detective Comics goes into the Batman Year 2 storyline, and over in Batman, we get the storyline that becomes the definitive origin of Jason Todd from this day forth, which is Batman is investigating some criminal activity in Gotham, and he comes across this kid trying to boost the tires off the Batmobile. That's Jason Todd. His parents are wrapped up in this criminal enterprise that involves Two-Face. They both die. Bruce eventually adopts him, and he becomes the new Robin. The way Dick Grayson had left being Robin this time around was actually a lot different than the pre-crisis version as well. In the pre-crisis, he does quit, but has more or less made up with Batman. They've buried a lot of different hatchets over the years, and there seems to be a friendly relationship. In the post-crisis, Batman essentially fires Robin after Dick is shot by the Joker, and there's a lot of tension between the two of them, which plays out throughout much of the rest of the 80s into the early 90s, and probably really starts to get patched up after Nightfall and the Prodigal storyline, and after Zero Hour, when Nightwing makes his way back over to the Bat offices under Denny O'Neil, as opposed to being part of the New Titans universe. Jason, of course, becomes more of a punk. My impression is always that he's been kind of wildly unpopular. He was fairly unpopular as the character of Robin. They have the character make a couple of really harsh decisions or bad mistakes, whatever you want to call them, that does lead to him possibly killing a criminal by letting him die. What this leads up to is the four-part Death in the Family storyline, where, of course, Robin goes searching for his real mother. He goes to the Middle East, and then he finds her, I think, in Ethiopia or in Africa, doing humanitarian work. But she's also skimming drugs and skimming money and things, and actually involved with the Joker. Basically, what happens is that he goes to confront his mother. The Joker catches him, beats him nearly to death with a crowbar, leaves a bomb in where him and his mother are, and boom. The end of issue 427 tells you that if you call one of two 900 numbers, you can either kill or save Jason Todd. And of course, the audience voted to kill him. And then we get Tim Drake, et cetera. And for the better part of not quite 20 years, maybe about 15, 16 years, Jason Todd's dead. He's always kind of in the background, especially in those first few years. There are mentions of him, and his costume hangs in the Batcave as a memorial. Then in and around 2005, which is the Infinite Crisis era, someone named the Red Hood is knocking off criminals in Gotham. Batman, of course, investigates, as does the others, and it's eventually revealed that said person is Jason Todd, and he has been alive this whole time. How? Well, in the annual that year, it seems that because Superboy Prime had been interfering with the universe and therefore trying to escape their prison and all the things that he and Alexander Luthor had been doing, he'd been inadvertently changing bits and pieces of reality. And one of those changes was that Jason Todd woke up in the coffin, escaped the coffin, and was eventually found and treated by Talia al Ghul. And since then, he's been a regular fixture in DC Comics as the Red Hood, both as an ally to Batman and as an adversary to Batman. So what DC did, though, recently, as the facsimile market, I guess, if you will, or the demand for facsimiles has grown after publishing a lot of different ones, and I have a couple. I know I have, I bought the Marvel Spider-Man 1 facsimile for Brett one time, and I myself have the Detective Comics number 38 facsimile. I might have another one somewhere, like an Adventure Comics one or something like that. But yeah, they've been kind of fun to read. So what DC did was they dusted off Batman number 428, and they put together the version of that issue that would have existed had Jason not died. Now, we saw a panel of that in Batman Annual 25 as part of the, and it's in the trade paperback for the storyline Under the Red Hood, which is the Aparo DiCarlo drawing that was the splash page of Batman smiling and looking to the heavens and saying he's alive, as opposed to the one we got in the original 428, which was him holding the dead body of Jason Todd with a kind of a shadow over his face. But what does that issue look like? And what would have happened had Jason Todd survived? Well, that's what I'm going to go over when I get back. Stick around.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
So I'm going to start with the Robin Lives version of issue number 428, which was written by Jim Starlin, pencils by Jim Aparo, and inks by Mike DiCarlo. Like in the original version, Robin and his mother had been caught in an explosion at the end of issue number 427. She dies, but when Batman comes upon Robin, he feels a pulse. He smiles and says he's alive and takes him to a hospital, and then he arranges to have the mom's body flown back to the United States. Now, the Joker plot of A Death in the Family seems to go the way it had gone in the original version. This is the whole weird thing with him being the ambassador to Iran and an appearance by Ayatollah Khomeini and the Joker off to poison everybody in the UN, Superman jumping in, etc. That doesn't really change. What changes is the Jason aspect of it. In the original version, they hold a funeral and there are two caskets there, both Jason and his mother. And this time around, it's just a funeral for Jason's mother. And we also have a new half page of Jason being in the hospital and Dick showing up. Dick offers to help track the Joker down, but Bruce says that he acts alone from now on. And this is a contrast, actually, to the confrontation that Dick and Bruce had when Dick found out about Jason's death. Now, that was in the New Titans number 55 or 56, the one where Donna Troy becomes Troya officially. And Dick berates Bruce for letting Jason be Batman when he wasn't ready. Bruce responds by decking him and yelling that never again he'll have a partner. He'll do it alone and driving out of the Batcave. Now, we've seen a different version of that in Batman number 428, and we're going to fast forward to from the DC Vault miniseries, A Death in the Family, Robin Lives. This was done by the creative team of J.M. DeMatteis, who is the writer, Rick Leonardi, the artist, Rico Renzi, the colorist, Taylor Esposito, letterers, and Rick Leonardi and Dave Stewart did the covers with variants by Mike Mignola and Dave Stewart. Katie Kubert and Michael McAllister are your editors. Of course, Batman was created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger, and Superman was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. So the Joker is dead. Someone shot him right between the eyes, and Batman was there. Batman sits in the Batcave watching the story unfold in the news. Robin cries on a rooftop in the rain. We then flash back or go back to Jason waking up in the hospital when he is recovering from the attack by the Joker. And in New York, the Joker is fired by the Iranian government as their ambassador to the United Nations. He threatens the Ayatollah's men, but Batman jumps in. The Joker jumps out a window with a jetpack strapped to his back, then gets on board a Joker boat wearing an admiral's uniform. Batman stops him and brings him back to Arkham. Arkham's director speaks out about compassion, and Batman leaves. At Wayne Manor, Jason is home and at the breakfast table. Jason says he's not hungry and then slaps Alfred's hand out of the way when Alfred offers him some food. He storms out of the room and onto the grounds of the manor while Bruce yells behind him. Dick walks up to Jason. Jason is in no mood for another lecture, but Dick offers just a talk. He thinks it's a positive conversation, but Jason's troubles go very deep. And it's here where we will meet our narrator. This is a psychiatrist named Dr. Saswati Dev. She's the head of the Dev Institute and has pioneered ways to help trauma victims. Jason overhears this and lashes out. He blames Bruce for everything that happened, then goes and heads out into the night, taking on the Scarecrow. He's smartly wearing a mask, but the Scarecrow pricks his arm and sends fear toxins into his bloodstream. He sees visions of being beaten by the Joker, but his mother shoots him. Jason is happy to see her, but she decays. Scarecrow turns to leave. Batman shows up and beats the ever-loving crap out of him, and then he takes Robin home. Chapter 2 opens with the Joker in Arkham threatening his therapist and being dragged out by security. Meanwhile, Batman investigates a suspect and then comes across Copperhead, who has been hired by the Russian mob to protect a child trafficking ring. Batman takes him down easily. At the Dev Institute, Jason has a session with Dr. Dev. She knows he's hiding something. He says it's stupid. He wants to go home. Later that night, Batman appears to her and takes off his mask. She asks him why he exposed the child to all of this, and he has no answer. We cut to Nightwing, who is in the middle of a fight with a villain. Batman helps finish that villain off, and then he goes back to Dick's apartment and stitches up knife wounds. He asks Dick if he thinks he would have been better off not being Robin. Dick starts to say sometimes, but before he can finish his sentence, Batman leaves. In Arkham, the Joker is in another therapy session, and he's actually contrite. He embraces his therapist. Has he turned the corner? No, that's not the Joker. It's Clayface. She kisses the doctor. The Joker has already escaped. Back at Wayne Manor, Bruce fires Jason from being Robin, and Jason is pissed. He throws Bruce out of his room. Dr. Dev sees Bruce and said he looks like he could use a friend. Chapter 3 opens with the same scene of the Joker having been shot between the eyes and Robin holding the gun. The Joker is in his hideout, an old video store, watching Buster Keaton movies with Batman and Robin. Batman laughs, but Robin thinks it's corny. Of course, this is all a product of the Joker's insanity. At Bruce's parents' grave, Dr. Dev talks to him about his parents' death, and her narration gives us a psychological evaluation of him. Then we switch to Mother Grimm's house. She's a villain that J.M. DeMatteis created in Legends of the Dark Knight 30 years ago. And so she kidnaps children and reprograms them into being obedient and violent. Now, he defeats her, but sees that they have truly bonded to her. And this causes him to reflect on whether or not making two boys Robin was the right idea. Alfred offers advice and comfort, pointing out that Batman does not need to be alone and is not alone. He is a family and a family of other heroes. Alfred's speech is interrupted by a call from Dr. Dev, who tells him, Batman, that Jason has left the Institute and is hunting the Joker. Batman takes off into the night and comes upon Nightwing, who wants to finish their conversation from earlier. Dick says that what Bruce gave him as Robin and as Nightwing is so much more and better than any regrets he may have had. So they head out to look for Jason, who is hanging a lawyer off of a building demanding to know where the Joker is. This leads to the video store where the Joker is waiting. He sends three robots in English police uniforms after Jason, and when the two finally come face to face, Robin freezes and sees the image of his dead mother. The Joker knocks him out, and we end with him standing next to Jason, who is dressed up as a clown, Jokey the Boy Lackey. Chapter 4 opens up at Dr. Steiner's house. And that's the Joker's old therapist. Robin is drugged up and working with the Joker, clubs him over the head. The Joker monologues and orders Jokey to beat the doctor to death. Jokey beats him to within an inch of his life, but can't bring down the killing blow. He turns on the Joker, who smacks him aside and then leaves him behind. Batman and Nightwing at the video store hideout find a note from the Joker who wants to face him alone. Batman drugs Nightwing, saying the drug will wear off in 3 hours and to go find Jason when he wakes up. At Dr. Stoner's house, Jason watches Stoner being led out on a stretcher, then wails in pain at what the Joker made him do. He goes back to the Batcave to change his costume and steals a gun from a gun store. Batman tracks Joker to a group of caves that is the only place from his message that can be found in the area. Joker brags that he's learned how to control the bats and is going to send them into the night carrying psychoactive agent, but the Joker offers a compromise. Drink something from a vial that will make Batman crazy. Because, as the Joker says, you're bats, and thinks they should make it official. A shot rings out. Joker is hit in the chest, but is wearing bulletproof clothing. He sees Robin and taunts him while Batman tries to talk Jason down. Jason fires the gun. Batman screams no. The Joker cries and says, at last. And we get the same scene from the very opening of our storyline. Batman chastises him, but Robin has vanished. Batman and Nightwing find him at a rooftop later. They want to know why Jason never came home. He says they hate him, and Batman says no, they love him and they always will. Nobody faces trial for the Joker's death. Batman retires. Dick eventually takes on the role. Bruce becomes a more visual philanthropist, and he and Dr. Dev fall in love and get married. As for Jason, he is treated at the Dev Institute, graduates college, and becomes an associate director at Arkham Asylum. Dr. Dev says, we were so proud of him. He'd faced so much, come so far. And when we knew beyond a doubt that Jason Todd had a good, valuable life ahead of him, that like Bruce and Dick, he'd leave a positive impact on the world. We close with Jason sitting in front of a mirror wearing a purple suit. He puts on a wig, white makeup, and red lipstick. We were wrong, Dr. Dev narrates as Jason stands in front of the mirror as the Joker and laughs, the reflection of Dick Grayson's Batman looking back at him. So looking at all of this, I find that the most disappointing thing in the whole bunch of issues that I have here is that facsimile edition of Batman number 428 with the alternate fate of Jason Todd, the Jim Aparo stuff. If I'm being honest, I don't know what I was supposed to expect. The story of a death in the family would have continued anyway, probably in the exact same way it exists in its original version. In fact, I would imagine that this would still have taken both Robin and the Joker off the table for a little bit, and that way Batman could work alone. By the way, Batman was working alone in Detective Comics at this point, which was nearing the Alan Grant, Norm Brayfogle run. That title had more or less an embargo on using Robin. I've read this has had something to do with the way that Mike W. Barr used Jason in that very pre-crisis way during his run. But either way, Robin would have gotten put by the wayside whether or not he had lived. What would have happened if Jason had lived in the regular comics? Would he have just simply retired and never been Robin again? Would he have become angrier and then had a heel turn like he does in this? Would he mature and would it make him smarter, make him more likable, so he would kind of become what Tim Drake became? We'll obviously never know. And in this series, J.M. DeMatteis has license to take this in any direction he wants and create a conclusive story since we're not dealing with continuity. You'll notice that this is narrated by an entirely new character. That's Jason's therapist, Dr. Dev. And she not only gets Batman to reveal himself, but ultimately falls in love with him. She's another character in a long line of women like Silver St. Cloud or Sasha Bordeaux, who a writer creates to give Batman more emotional depth. It works here for two reasons. First, like the two characters I mentioned, she's likable and she's intriguing. Second, Batman is so affected by what happens that this winds up being the conclusion of the story, of his story. I don't know if this will annoy anyone, but I can see how Robin almost dying can push him to the point where he gives it all up, especially when Dr. Dev helps him see the bigger picture. He created the idea of Robin to rescue a kid and help build a legacy. After Jason recovers, he comes to realize that the legacy is more than just simply beating up criminals, and that is in Jason's eventual rehabilitation. That's the better legacy. It's also in the character of Dick Grayson who winds up being the literal legacy Batman. Of course, DeMatteis is ignoring the New Titans at this point, because which was still being published, and Nightwing was the team leader. But if you bring that in, you wind up with like the story being really muddied because you have to bring up too much of the outside DC universe. So for simplicity's sake, Dick comes back into the fold, then the timing does actually work. Because between Jason's death and Barbara's being shot, there's a lot that's going on in Dick's, quote, family. And he does leave the Titans during this time anyway. He eventually will come back about a year or two later, right before the Titans Hunt issue. But he does train Tim Drake. So this could have been the same thing just without Tim. And he is trying to be the older brother to Jason, which tracks by how Jim Starlin wrote him in Batman number 416, where he met Jason for, quote, the first time. And they had kind of a heart-to-heart about what being Robin is, and Dick had given him his other Robin costume, the bigger one. It's such a great issue if you've never read it. So we've got that, and we've got one huge departure from the Batman continuity, which is Jason killing the Joker. And it's almost as if DeMatteis is addressing that long-asked question, why doesn't Batman just kill the Joker? I don't think anybody would miss the guy. And he kind of gets his cake and eats it too, because Batman does not kill him. In fact, he tries to get Jason to not kill him, and Jason does it anyway. And having Robin, who had been physically and mentally assaulted by the Joker, do it totally works here. You can see the motive behind it, and you can see Jason couldn't take it anymore, snapped, or whatever you want to call it. We saw him under the Joker's control almost beat someone to death. You know, that person didn't deserve to die, and that's what did snap Jason out of it. But the Joker, again, nobody faces consequences for his death, because I think just about everybody in Gotham City, from the mayor on down to the basic beat cop, would have wanted to put a bullet in his brain anyway. The Batman that DeMatteis gives us is very much the Batman of this time, and the same with the Joker. So it still have been the 80s, so we're talking about the last gasp of the villains with wild gadgets and cars with their faces on them. Joker's got a Joker boat, some other action figure craziness. The tone, though, is like the post-Frank Miller grittier tone. It's that Batman that would settle in during the 90s, which wasn't total Frank Miller Batman, but there was more of a little bit more of an edge to Batman as he went through the post-crisis era. About a year before Death of the Family, DeMatteis wrote Kraven's Last Hunt in the Spider-Man books. This was a storyline that's actually one of my all-time favorites. I have the trade paperback signed by him, Bob McLeod, and Mike Zeck. Anyway, he had the Spidey of the moment and one of his more outlandish villains, but with such a darker tone, and he's doing that here with Batman, Robin, and the Joker. And what really helps it is Rick Leonardi's art. I've seen his work in various places over the years, mostly in Marvel books like The Uncanny X-Men, Cloak and Dagger, and Spider-Man 2099. But really only bits and pieces of his work. I've seen the X-Men stuff, and then the Cloak and Dagger and Spider-Man, I've read bits and pieces of that. He has a segment in Batman 400 and several issues of Nightwing in 2002. He's a great choice for this, mainly because his art on the series reminds me of Klaus Janson from around the same time. You know, think those early issues of The Punisher. But with enough of the Bronze Age Batman artists like Ed Hannigan and Don Newton mixed in to not make it too much like a third generation copy of Frank Miller. He draws a great Batman. He also draws an intimidating enough Joker, a great Robin. Robin's a tough character to get right, especially when you're trying to portray him as an early adolescent as opposed to very young or much older. Leonardi makes Jason look like a teenager of the time and does a great job with the costume, showing that the incongruity between it being a teen wonder and a boy wonder. Plus, he also makes Jason look vulnerable and small when he's being attacked by Scarecrow and the Joker. And I have to give some praise for Rico Renzi's coloring. And no shade to Adrienne Roy. She was the colorist on the original Batman books. And she was always consistent. I always think she deserves tons of praise for helping make the character who he is. But the events of the death of the family and its daytime setting, plus the brightness that came with it, always seemed kind of in opposition to the tone of the story. Much of this series, the Robin Lives series, is set at night. And Renzi does a good job of making the story moody and spooky and dark without feeling like it's muddy in the way that so many comics have felt on and off for a while in the coloring. especially like 10 or 15 years ago. These days, the coloring in comics really has improved a lot, and we're not getting a ton of that kind of muddy, muddy coloring. And I'm glad we're coming out of that era, because I don't like that comics that are so dark, they're hard to see. You know, like some comics don't need that as far as the mood is concerned. And I like the fact that when we see comic book coloring, the art form is really improved to really talk about tone, mood, and the other literary elements that the colorists from years ago did and did very well. But I think the advancements in the art, technology of art, have improved so much that people have really fine-tuned it to do something really, really cool. Anyway, two notes before I get talking about the ending of the miniseries. First, Leonardo does draw a great disco costume Nightwing. So the Nightwing that we see is the original costume. This was before any of the miniseries or anything else. The costume is not easy to draw if you aren't George Perez or Tom Grummett. So many who drew it over the years made the collar look too big or just made it generally look too silly. Leonardo not only gets the collar right, but he makes Dick Grayson look comfortable and confident wearing it. Then he has Dick create a new Batman costume that combines the classic Batman with a bit of Nightwing thrown in. It is a really great look. And now there's the ending. You got the Joker's death. Jameson is seemingly cured, and he ends up going to Arkham to become one of the directors. And then he is the Joker. He has resurrected the Joker, and he is that. I thought the Joker's death was well done. By having it open the series, De Matteis teases it, but doesn't give us any pretense that it's going to be a typical Batman story where yet again the Joker gets away. Like it wasn't, this is only a dream or something. You really can't have that happen anyway in a story like this. There has to be some sort of conclusion in that sense, a finality to the Joker story. And that's what we get. Plus, when the death itself comes, the Joker cries a tear and whispers "at last" before taking the bullet in the head. It's a bit on the dramatic side, but I do like the idea of his mask slipping in the final moment. Perhaps whomever is buried under all of those layers of insanity finally feels something akin to peace. Now, as for Jason becoming the Joker, it sets up a new Batman-Joker dynamic in this Elseworld sort of place. I guess it does work. Bruce gets his happy ending for a moment and all seems well. I guess the question is, was this dormant all along? And if so, what woke it up? Or did Jason know he was going to do this pretty early on? Was this the result of the whole Jokey the Boy Lackey thing? They leave us with a good amount of questions. And I have to say, this would be an interesting miniseries to have a sequel for. Like The Joker Lives or something like that, where Dick Grayson takes on the Jason Todd Joker. Clearly, at the end of the series, they don't know he's the Joker yet. So there's a whole potential for something, a sequel storyline. The only thing I would say, though, is don't put Bruce back in the Batman costume. Have Dick be the one who fights as Batman, and Bruce is there in the background dealing with it as civilian Bruce Wayne. I think De Matteis would be a great writer for this. The same creative team would be a great writer for this. And I don't necessarily know how this sold or if DC has any ideas for a sequel. If I ever meet J.M. De Matteis again and bring him these to sign, I'll have to ask him. Same thing with Rick Leonardi. But yeah, it was a great read. I wasn't too skeptical going into it because the creative team sounded great and I like the idea of the story, but sometimes these Elseworlds stories have a way of, or these kind of like, you know, alternate what-if stories have a way of not sticking the landing when it comes to the concept. Maybe they run out of time to tell the story and because they built up too much, or maybe it was clearly that the concept was there, but nobody actually thought about what the story should be. This really does it. It hits every note that needs to be hit. And it had that feel of the late 80s and early 90s Batman. It was intriguing. It's worth tracking down if you can find it. I think it might be in trade already. I'm not sure. I have the individual issues myself. And it's a good companion to the original storylines of a death in the family, a lonely place of dying, and under the Red Hood. So, yeah. That's Robin living, the Joker dying. And that's it for this episode. I don't have any feedback this time around. I will say, though, I got an interesting blog comment on an old post that I did about that Wind Song perfume commercial from the early 1990s, you know, the girl riding on the bike and I can't seem to forget you, your wind song stays in my mind. And there was a comment years ago when somebody had asked about like somebody who was in one of the older versions of that commercial, one from like the 70s or something. And this was from 2023. It was from Cheryl Velasquez. She said, is there any way you can find the Windsong commercial that has a woman on a train, the man outside the train, and the man holds the hand to the window and she does the same back? I've been trying to find it myself, but I can't. Please help me. And then Anthony Gray on March 12th of 2026, so about 3 years later, posted, a lady asked about the commercial with a man and a lady on a train, but I'm not sure if my reply went. The lady is my wife's first cousin, Andy Johnson, who was a Ford model at the time. After seeing years of searching, we found it on TikTok, and he sent me a link to it and such. And I said, you know, I got back to him a few days later, and I said, I wanted to let you know that's awesome. Something like this has happened a few times. I'm always amazed when it does. And he said, no problem. The lady who asked the question apparently had some relationship with the guy in the video. If he wants to chat with Andy for old time's sake, I could try to make that happen. And again, it's a random set of comments across 3 years on a blog post about a perfume commercial. But based on what you heard last episode when I talked about Whitewater Summer, that has happened a couple of times. One of my all-time favorite bits on the original blog, aside from that, was that the fact that there was a back and forth about the guy from the Dr. Pepper commercials in the early 90s and his like cousin or sister had commented and things like that. So when that happens, it's always like really, really cool. So that was a little bit of kind of quasi-feedback on that. If you got any feedback for me, feel free to send it to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. And you can comment on Facebook, Blue Sky, or Instagram. And I always say this, but I promise I'm going to use Instagram even more. And that'll do it for this month. Come back next month for another random topic. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is hosted and produced by me, Tom Panarese. The theme music is Pop Rock by Scott Holmes and is used under Creative Commons licensing. You can contact and follow me via email at popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Pop Culture Affidavit, and on Blue Sky as Pop Aff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. And of course, you can find episode links, show notes, and blog posts on my website, popcultureaffidavit.com. Thanks very much for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.